Hello and welcome back for another round of Ground Under Repair. It's a promise many of us have made to ourselves over the years. If we ever get good enough, we'll try and qualify for the US Open. But what's that like, and what does it even take to arrive at the local qualifying rounds? My guest this week, the USGA's Bill McCarthy, knows all about that, having been involved with the USGA's various championships for over 20 years. Open qualifying begins this week, so in a way the second major of the year begins this coming Tuesday. You're listening to Ground Under Repair on the Podcast Lab Network. Ground Under Repair, where golf is for everyone. My guest this week is Bill McCarthy of the USGA, here to talk about US Open qualifying and the USGA's array of championships. Bill, welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me on.
You serve as the championship director for the US Amateur Four Ball Championships as well as the US Amateur.
Correct. I've been on staff with the USGA for 21 years now. In the last 10 to 12 years, I've been in rules and competitions and served as the staff in charge of the Amateur Public Links for 12 years and the Mid-Am for the last 7 or 8 years. And then when we recently started our new four-ball championship, I took that one on.
And, yeah, the four-ball championship, I was just mentioning it before we started, that it really jumped out at me in the research for this. It's a newer event, started in 2014, but it certainly has my full attention now.
Oh, it's remarkable. Talking about a little bit about the history of the four ball, I can remember 15 years ago or more being in competitions meetings with Mike Davis, who was either running the Mid-Am and the U.S. Open at the time or stepping up into the senior director rules and competitions role. And way back then, he would talk about, hey, wouldn't it be cool if we ran a foursomes championship or a four-ball championship? And to watch those conversations develop and then the championships come to fruition was really exciting.
There's something special about an event that involves teams of two, because we're so used to golf and in individual, the player against the course and also the field format. So it's fascinating to see an event that involves teams of two like that. We're getting a little bit of a taste of it on television this weekend with the Zurich Classic, but the US Amateur Four Ball really stands out largely because of the word amateur. It's something that a wider array of people can qualify for, and it's people who, presumably, these are people who have known each other for years and have played together for a long time. Many of us have golfing buddies out there. I'm sure we can all appreciate that.
Well, you're right, and I think, you know, one of the main reasons we wanted to introduce these two new championships, the men's and the women's four balls, is that, you know, four ball, whether we know it or not, is generally what we play when we go out at our clubs on the weekends or join up with our buddies during the week at night in our leagues. We tend to play four ball. You know, in casual play, we may call it best ball, but it's two against two, or just taking the better ball of the two players on each hole in a stroke play competition. So it really reflects how we play golf for the most part in the United States. And you're right, there's just a totally different vibe about this championship. You know, when we had the first one at the Olympic Club just a couple of years ago, as the players came on site, there was a whole different energy. And it was because it was just wasn't them against the golf course and them posting a score. There was a whole new energy regarding their relationship with their partner, with other players that they knew who called on other folks to be their partners. And that just added a whole different look and feel from a social aspect. And then on top of it, it just ties into a different, you know, the format itself lends itself to different play. A little bit of thinking around how are you going to, you know, play the golf course? If you hit a bad shot, how am I going to play? So there's a real interaction in terms of the format and how the partners or the sides make their way around the golf course.
It's funny too. I looked at the previous champions, and you can see the range of ages right away that the original champions are guys in their 40s for the U.S. Amateur Four Ball, and then the reigning champions are 20 and 21, or were when they won the championship. So that's a pretty wide array right there, and just the short history of this championship of age ranges.
Oh, and I think that speaks to the quality of the championship itself and how enthusiastic the players are about it. At the championship proper, in the last couple of years, we've had, players 15 and 16 years old and players up in their early 60s. We've had brothers, we've had dads and sons, we've had best friends, we've had elite players just get together because they weren't real good friends, but they had a good shot at playing well in the championship. So the variety of players is fantastic. There are so many good stories about how players got together to play and do well. You talked about the year one where Nathan Smith and Todd White, two Walker Cup players, and Nathan being a four-time Mid-Am champion, just played incredibly well to take home the first championship. And then last year, our two players out of SMU, college players. So we're seeing a real diverse demographic in this championship for sure.
Over 2,000 teams have entered in, or there have been 2,000 entries over in each of the previous championships when you include the qualifying. So in that respect, the event seems to have taken off pretty much instantly.
It did, and we were not surprised. As soon as we opened up entries, they started flooding in. And right after the first year, in terms of entries, the four ball popped right to the front in terms of our interest for our championships. We've got our Open that is just our most popular, clearly, and then the U.S. Amateur. And then right behind them now is the Mid-Am and the four ball with around 45 to 5,000 individual entries. So I think that speaks very well to the success of the championship.
And the host course this year will be Pinehurst number 2, where the USGA has formed a pretty special connection over the years.
Oh, you bet. I've had the privilege of working with the folks at Pinehurst for the last two and a half years, geared up for this championship, which is just in a couple of weeks. And our relationship with Pinehurst has been amazing. The staff there, Ben Bridgers, the director of golf and general manager, and Brian Fahey, their operations tournament director, along with Tom Pashley, the president of Pinehurst Resort and Country Club, have just been fantastic to work with. Their agronomic team, led by Bob Farron, has worked many U.S. Opens. And I think, again, it speaks to the four-ball championship itself. We really didn't have to work hard to get this initial lineup of championship sites for the four-ball. We started with Olympic, and that, from what I understand, it really took just one light conversation in terms of would you be interested in hosting the championship. And then last year we were at Wingfoot, the site of multiple U.S. Opens, U.S. Amateurs, Women's Opens. And this year, incredibly lucky to get to Pinehurst, followed by Jupiter Hills next year, then going out to Chambers Bay, another U.S. Open site. And then last lined up on our calendar so far is Philly Cricket Club in 2020, which is going to be a fantastic site also.
Yeah, that last one will be close to home for the USGA, being based out of New Jersey, the organization itself.
Yeah, our HQ is in Far Hills, New Jersey, which is kind of centrally located in the state. But we've got a number of field offices, agronomists around the country. Our U.S. Open team works out of Pinehurst. And we do try to spread our championships around, but whenever we're in the Northeast, it does make it a little bit operationally, a little bit easier.
You mentioned several different levels of championships and how they're really taking off in terms of entrance. And I think that's something that draws people to all these USGA championships is that it's extremely democratic, that we play golf all over the country. And if you meet the qualifying standards in terms of handicap, you can apply, or in the four ball, you can get a pairing together and apply.
and try and qualify and try and pit yourself against the best out there at your level. And I think that's something that's drawn people to the USGA from the very beginning, and it's what stands out about their entire array of championships all the way up to and including the US Open itself.
Well, that's nice of you to say, and I would agree. I mean, you know, the bottom line is, can you play or not? And, you know, the player with the best ability and the best determination is gonna face that, you know, ultimate test of golf when they come to the USGA Championship, you know, whether it's our four balls or our open championships or our juniors or our men's and women's amateur. And then we get into the fall where we see our two mid-ams and our two senior-ams. We like to think that those individual championships for the individual demographics that play, that they are their ultimate tests. That when those players ultimately hoist the trophy, they would have accomplished a great deal in terms of shot making, in terms of mental and physical resolve, in terms of understanding the architecture of the golf course and course management, that championship is going to test their overall ability and prove that they are worthy of raising that trophy.
And to that end, it can be a grueling way forward, because qualifying rounds for the U.S. Open Championship begin next week. In fact, the first one's on Tuesday. Players at 114 sites all over the country will compete for sectional qualifying spots. From there, the lucky few will might be able to join the field at Erin Hills. And I suppose it would be safe for me to say that the people who play next week are the truly ambitious.
Oh, you bet. You know, entries this year closed just the other day, just last Wednesday, and we accepted 9,485 entries into the U.S. Open this year. You know, as you said, there's 114 local qualifying sites around the country, which any number of those players try to get through. Then we ultimately have 12 sectional qualifying rounds, two international, one in Ono City, Japan, and one in Surrey, England. They're on May 22nd and 29th, respectively. And then on June 5th, we have 10 U.S. sectional qualifying rounds all around the country, which will include those that got through local qualifying, plus 455 locally exempt players competing for the last spots to get into the championship proper. And I'll tell you, when you talk about the democracy of the championship, the Open's the best one. There's no question. And I'll give you a great example. As every year I have the opportunity to work the U.S. Open sectional in Columbus, and that's the day after Muirfield. So that field of 132 players that play in the sectional on that Monday are ones more likely that either got through local or they were exempt through local and had played in Muirfield, or they got through local and chose to come to Columbus to play in the sectional. And during the course of that day, you see juniors, you see high school players, collegiate players, mid-amateurs competing against tour players for these final spots. And I think my favorite part of the day is that night. That's Monday night, the playoff, because so many times I've conducted the playoff at this qualifier, and you'll have an assistant pro from somewhere in Ohio teeing it up against a former major championship winner to try to get into the Open. It's pretty cool.
I can't help but agree with you. It really does stand out. It jumps out across the professional schedule. This is the tournament I personally always, that's the one I always look forward to the most, because because anyone that's good enough can qualify and make it. And it's often at a public course. A lot of the regional sites are public courses as well. These are places that anyone can walk up and play and test themselves, and certainly the U.S. Open is the test of golf. But of course, a lot of people aspire to one day get good enough that they can try and qualify. I think when we talk about that, We always overlook how rigorous this has to be by nature. Am I correct to say these are not events for people who are just happy to be there?
You're right. You know, again, when we've got the philosophy of the USGA championships are going to be the ultimate test in golf. So when someone comes to qualifies for a USGA championship, number one, qualifying is going to be a good, solid test. Whether it's an 18-hole local qualifier or a 36-hole sectional qualifier, or when you talk about some of our amateur championships, 36-hole stroke play qualifying to get in the match play. You know, you are going to be tested physically. You're going to be tested mentally. You're going to be tested from a course preparation and a course management standpoint, driving the ball long and straight, short iron accuracy, mid irons, long irons, hybrids, rough and recoverability, you know, putting on firm, fast putting greens. Every aspect of your game is going to be tested. And part of that overall test is how you react to bad breaks. How do you react to poor shots? How do you react to that one, you know, that one great shot that bounds off the flagstick into a bunker? All of that adds up in terms of the demanding test that we provide.
And there is a big difference between someone who just has a handicap low enough that they could apply and someone who is truly competitive, who is willing to go through it and willing to put themselves to the test.
Well, I would agree. You just don't play casually and qualify for a USGA championship. You've got to focus. You've got to try to improve your game and demonstrate a well-rounded game. Not to say that, you know, folks can't work on the game a bit and get a bit of shot. You know, that speaks again to the democracy of it. If they're eligible, boy, we welcome you to file an entry. Absolutely. But when it gets right down to it, you better be prepared to play, because whether you're qualifying for the, you know, the U.S. Women's Mid-Am or the U.S. Women's Open, it's competition, and they're there to play.
I'm glad you brought it back to encouraging people to apply. Certainly, you're not discouraging anyone, telling anyone to stay home. In fact, there are people who are good enough to put in for one of these championships that are competitive and know competitive golf, and they've just never thought of putting their hat into the ring. What would you say to the worthy golfer who fits the profile of somebody who could fit in at qualifying for one of these events who's never tried it?
I would encourage them to try, without a doubt. The experience, whether you end up qualifying or advancing to sectional qualifying, the experience in itself is just different. You know, I was talking the other day to some of my colleagues, and one of my colleagues from the communications department was talking to a former NHL goalie who always played golf, but once he retired, you know, he got into golf competitively. And he said he was never more nervous than when he stepped on the first tee for U.S. Open local qualifying than ever in the Stanley Cup Finals that he had played goalie. I mean, and that's pretty remarkable. It's just a different deal. So I would say, yeah, I mean, if you've got players who are eligible, you're out there, you're competing at a local level, at your club level, file an entry for a USGA championship. Get out there and see what you're made of. Go through the experience. It's a lot of fun, and it's a great challenge.
I'm glad you mentioned the goalie attempting to qualify, because we do hear a fair amount. We see occasionally on television when they do the pro-am kind of tournaments, we see these celebrity golfers or former athletes in other sports that have pretty good games, at least we see from what we've heard and what we've seen. So it's interesting to see someone like that try their mettle on the golf course with everybody else. That's fascinating as well.
You bet. We see a lot of that, you know. Even, you know, in our mid-am, we've had a number of former Major League players, Major League Baseball players, try to qualify and qualify for the championship. I think even when professional athletes retire, they still have that need for competition. You know, they've still got that drive. And I think golf really provides them a great opportunity.
Of course, the U.S. Open is famous for tweaking the course that hosts the championship to make it a particularly tough test. Does that also extend to the qualifying sites? For example, I live in Massachusetts. If I were to go play Pine Hills after they have the regional or the local qualifier there, should I bring extra golf balls?
Well, it speaks to a couple of things there. I mean, you know, Mike Davis and Jeff Hall do an incredible job in terms of setting up the course for the U.S. Open. But, you know, I hope everybody understands that, you know, this is not a battle of the players versus the USGA. You know, the championship sites that we go to, whether it's for, you know, the four ball, the mid-am, or the U.S. Open, they're great sites within themselves. And those sites lend themselves to great setups. You know, we've talked about the idea of course setup over the number of years, last number of years, and it's become very popular as a conversation. You know, but these great golf courses don't need a lot of work from our end, you know. Depending upon the demographic, like the U.S. Open, sure, you know, maybe we need a little bit more length, maybe a little bit more speed and firmness in the putting greens. But inherently, these great golf courses present great tests. And the whole concept of quality course setup is to allow players to shine and demonstrate their ability. But at the same time, when they do miss a drive or miss an approach shot, you know, those courses present themselves with difficulty to recover. And you know, we like to say, again, you know, golf's ultimate tests are the USGA championships.
That's, I had Bruce Charlton, who was part of the design team for Chambers Bay, on a few weeks ago talking about the design of golf courses in general. And certainly on his end, he couldn't have been happier with how that course was presented for the 2015 U.S. Open. So the USGA has always done a very good job presenting the course. And I think that's something, that's another thing that draws people to that particular tournament and to USGA events. As golfers, we are always trained to believe it's us versus the course. Well, when it's that tough a test, when it comes to those championships, sometimes when you're a spectator, you're kind of rooting for the course. You're kind of rooting for everyone else to go through the tough shots that we all go through on our weekly rounds. So I think that's part of the allure of the USGA championships in general, is how it's a great display of the courses themselves as well.
I would agree. And we're very lucky in that aspect for all of our championships. We're very fortunate that some great clubs around the country show interest to host. And I think it's important for your listeners to understand how actually our championship selection process works. From, you know, the U.S. Open to the Girls Junior, which is held every July, we work on an invitation basis. Clubs actually send formal invitations to us to host championships. And our future amateur sites committee and our championship committee review these invitations, and we meet with the clubs and evaluate the club and the facilities and the resources, and try to come to a meeting of the minds, so to speak, in terms of what would be a good fit for that host site. So it's a great relationship, you know, hand in hand with the host clubs to put on a great show.
We'll be back with Bill McCarthy of the USGA after a short break. This is Ground Under Repair on the Podcast Lab Network. Hey everybody, Tim Williams here to tell you about Podcast Lab. We're a group of writers, most of us sports writers like myself, who are taking our material to the world of podcasting. There's the Sunshine Boys podcast, where Jim Williams hosts longtime Tampa sports writers Joe Henderson and Ira Kaufman as they take you through the week in sports. Joe also joins Tom Jackson and moderator Jim Williams for the Politically Incorrect podcast, giving you a taste of the political pulse of Florida. Puck University is our college hockey podcast, giving you a glimpse into the world of college hockey. Conference Call with Jim Williams breaks down the big events of the college sports calendar from the people who make it happen. Speaking of inside looks, get an inside look on golf, golf courses, and all things related to fairways and greens on Ground Under Repair. There's also my sports podcast, The Pickup Game with Tim Williams, giving you weekly takes on sports from a Bucks fan who loves Boston. All this with more to come on the Podcast Lab Network, writers experimenting in podcasting.
Switching gears just a little bit, the USGA is also, of course, among the world's foremost authorities on the rules of golf, as we, the members, know every year because we get the little book with the rules written out for us, so we have the nice handy guide every year. As this podcast is about golf as most of us play it, and the name itself comes from the rules of the game, I can't help but ask, to make your case for the average golfer out there, why we should go put in the work in and get a real handicap?
Well, that's a great question. I'm glad you brought it up. You know, the USGA handicap system has been around for, in some sort of fashion, since the mid-1920s. You know, obviously it's evolved over the years, and we're currently in the process of working with other governing bodies around the world to put together a world handicap system based on the USGA slope system. But the handicap system is the great equalizer in the game. You know, when you talk about any other sport, whether it be, you know, football, basketball, whatever it might be, you know, we're never going to step on to the court and compete, you know, with Larry Bird in his prime or, you know, Carmelo Anthony at the Knicks. You know, they're just going to clean our clocks, you know, but we can step onto the golf course and we can compete against Dustin Johnson, because we can either go to a relative set of teeing grounds, or we can play from the same set of tees, and we adjust our handicap to the course, to that specific course, and receive a certain amount of shots so that we can compete against that level of player. And I think that's the great reason to go out and get a handicap, because when you're out there playing just your, you know, if you're playing every Saturday morning with just your buddies and you know how you play and you're going to have some fun, you know, that's one thing. But if you're going to be an active golfer playing different courses, playing with different people, I fully support, you know, establishing a handicap index. And it's a lot easier than folks think. You know, you don't have to belong to a private club. You can just go down to your local public facility. Guaranteed they've got a group there that you can join very easily and establish your handicap index. It's a great backbone of the game.
I think for most people, the only real difference would be that you're not allowed to go by any of those unwritten rules that we've always put on the game at the duffer's level, as it were, the kind of mulligan kind of rules. Those go by the wayside when you're doing anything official. And that's another reason I think people should try it, is because, you know, you go out with friends, you go have a fun round of golf, but it's hard to tell how good you really are until you play with all of the rules intact and you don't give yourself any leeway and you just see how well you do against the course and you do it enough times that you get a handicap and you find out, all right, this is where I really am as a golfer. It's a sport of humility in a lot of ways, and it's a sport of measuring yourself against both the course and yourself, and you can't really do that without a benchmark.
You're exactly right, and I don't think we want to scare some folks away from establishing a handicap. You know, the handicap system is very flexible in terms of scores that can be posted. You know, as long as the round was played, you know, according to the principles of the rules, that's a valid score. You play at least 13 holes, you can post a score. We've got a methodology for posting scores for those remaining holes. You know, if you happen to pick up on a hole, boy, we've got something for that. There's something called equitable stroke control, which doesn't allow that freakishly high score on an individual hole to negatively impact your handicap. So, you know, it's a whole process that's entailed with the handicap system that encourages people to utilize it and play the game.
I think that's another good place to explore a little bit as well, that we look at the official rules of golf sometimes as intimidating because it always seems like it's out there almost to make the game harder, but that's not necessarily true. People are always working on these and they've come up with ways to make it more equitable for someone who's playing, who's not of the level of the low handicapper.
Correct. You know, and the rules of golf over time have always evolved. And I think our recent efforts, our modernization efforts, to make the rules a little bit more understandable, a little bit more attractive to people, have been well received. You know, earlier this year, we introduced some draft rules that we're considering implementing in the beginning of 2019. And we put all those draft rules out there for people to review and comment and give us their thoughts. In terms of the application of the rules, in terms of the understanding of the rules, it's a very open and transparent process, and we're getting some fantastic feedback, not just from state and regional golf associations and national governing bodies around the country and the world, but from individual golfers in terms of the proposed rules changes for 2019.
Bill McCarthy of the USGA, thank you so much for coming on the show this week and discussing some of the parts of USGA championships that we just don't see or we don't think that much about, and the rules themselves as well. Thank you so much.
You bet, Tim. Thanks so much for having me on, and wishing all your listeners all the best. Hit them straight.
That's our show for this week. Thanks again to Bill McCarthy of the USGA for taking the time to talk with me. You can check out all the different USGA championships and the rules of golf at usga.org. I'm your host, Tim Williams. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Thanks as always to Blog Talk Radio for hosting. Until next week, this has been Ground Under Repair. Fairways and greens, everyone.